There's no doubt the digital revolution has changed the world. It's altered the way people read, shop, and play, and along the way transformed or eliminated many of the common objects and experiences of our daily lives. But business reporter David Sachs has noted a recent resurgence of the physical and a return to pleasures of shared space and beloved objects. His new book, The Revenge of the Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter, is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you, Leonard.
And, of course, I have a copy of it as a physical book, not as a Kindle.
One would hope.
Did the word digital mean what it means today when we lived in an analog world?
I think, you know, digital, it's a language, right? It's the world translated into ones and zeros. But over the past couple decades, especially with the rise of the internet and then the smartphone, digital has become something much greater. It's almost a way of approaching the world. And the world has become, in some ways, divided into, you know, digital perspectives and analog perspectives.
How many of the analog devices of just a few decades ago are still the norm?
Well, I think...
I'm not talking about a wristwatch because you can get digital wristwatches.
Right, of course. You know, increasingly with each year, analog stops being the norm, stops being the default, and digital has become that. So photography, right? The vast majorities of pictures taken today are digital photos, and that's really something over the past 15 years that's completely changed. Music is, you know, similar. Again, there's been a rebirth in records, but the vast majority today is digital music.
When you can reduce the world to ones and zeros or ons and offs, black and white, do you lose something?
Certainly. I mean, the world is not a binary thing of again, a one or a zero. It's much richer in its texture and its experiences. And I think it's impossible to translate all of that into digital. At the end of the day, it's all just being brought back to you by a small, flat screen. And yet the physical world we live in is a much, you know, richer environment.
When did you start to notice the return of some objects in your life that were thought to be extinct?
It was a couple years ago, probably around 2007, 2008. I remember when I was living here at the time, my good friend David Levy gave me a turntable for my birthday. And I hadn't had one in a couple years, and I started, you know, buying records again, picking records up off the street, and noticing that other people were doing it as well, that there were turntables popping up in stores, record stores popping up in the part of Brooklyn where I lived, where previously they had all sort of gone out of business. That seemed to be sort of the canary in the coal mine.
Had you asked for a turntable?
I hadn't, but I think anyone... you know, with a decent soul and a music lover appreciates that as a gift.
But isn't music available everywhere digitally now, a lot less expensive than when music lovers had to buy expensive audio equipment and all the latest albums? Now, if I think of a song, for example, I just simply go to my phone or my computer, and things that I wouldn't have had in my record collection just pop up.
Exactly. And I do the same when I'm walking my child to daycare, when I'm driving in the car, when it's something that I don't own. But what's lost from that, right? The experience of actually owning the music, of actually caring about it, of listening to that album again. I find when I'm listening to something digitally, I'll listen to it and then I'm always on to the next thing because, again, you have a limitless selection. So, oh, what's next? What's better? What's new? Whereas an album, if I own it, like, you know, Cannonball Adderley, something else, I can listen to it hundreds, if not thousands of times because it's there.
Unfortunately, then it gets scratched. It gets warped. There are pops on it. The record skips. Isn't that one of the other reasons that people consider digital to be preferable?
Of course.
Digital, what does the analog give you? Audiophiles say it gives you a higher quality.
Well, I think, first of all, quality is a very subjective thing, right? You can listen to scratchy records on a cheap turntable and it won't sound as good as the best digital files on a high-end stereo. You can also listen to, you know, very high compression digital files on cheap headphones and listen to, you know, a $3,000 stereo and a freshly pressed audiophile record. I think most people are gravitating to a return to, let's say, vinyl records or things like film cameras, not so much because of the qualitative experiences of the pure quality of it, but for the overall experience of engaging with it, right? Analog forces you to engage in a much deeper and more concentrated way.
How far back should we go? I remember when the LP, the 33 RPM LP, became the norm, and people said, well, 78s were just so much better.
And listen, there are people who gravitate towards that. I don't think it's a question, again, of one is better than the other. I think the people today who are buying books are also reading articles online or on Kindles or other e-readers. I think people who are writing in Moleskine notebooks are also using tablets and computers. Analog is another tool, but I think it's the assumption and the false assumption that digital would just do away with these things.
You open your book with a quote from Marshall McLuhan. What did he have to say about a new medium?
I think it's, you know, the idea that a new medium always seems as though it's going to be pushed out, or it's going to push out the old medium. But in a way, then it sort of absorbs it and works with it and gives that old medium a new life. And that's what you're seeing today. It's not as though vinyl records are going to come back and take over all the streaming services. But suddenly, because you can get any song and any album anywhere at any time, the $30 record that you can go buy at a store, which is cumbersome and prone to scratches, suddenly takes up space, but that gives it a different value, right? It becomes like a piece of art. It becomes a luxury, and in a way, we crave it more.
Are most of the people who shop at your local record store music connoisseurs?
I think, you know, those who are going to go and spend money on music these days, on physical music, are going to be the sort of people who care the most about music. They tend to be younger. You know, this return of records is not being driven by people of your generation or even of my generation, but, you know, the beloved millennials who are sort of blamed for everything. People who've grown up only with digital music. The same thing with sort of cameras, right? The instant film cameras, the Impossible Project, which makes film for Polaroid cameras and Fuji Instax. The people who are buying those photos are 15-year-olds who've never seen anything but a photo on an iPhone.
It's been my experience that the people who want vinyl these days are in their 20s or 30s. So it can't be nostalgia that's driving it. What is driving it?
I think it is the simple truth that in a world where so many of our experiences are digital and happen through our phone or through our screens, the appeal of something that's real and tangible is open to so many people. And I think that richness of that experience is so apparent when you engage in it, when you go into a bookstore, when you pick up a book, when you write on a piece of paper, that for the people who are looking for that, for that real experience, it's almost a primal thing, right? People say we live in a digital world, we live in a digital age, and that you and I are sitting here in a physical space talking over FM radio, right? Airwaves shooting out through the air.
There was a time when FM was only for a select few,
yeah,
and you couldn't buy many radios that had FM. So, and now, of course, it's the norm. Isn't that a similar thing to what we've been seeing with digital?
Exactly. And I think, again, once something becomes the norm, and everybody uses it and it becomes the default, it's kind of boring, right? There's nothing special about
I'm
it.
I'm happy to be on FM, by the way.
I love FM.
I started on AM, now I'm on both, but the bigger audience is still on FM and the sound quality is better.
And I think there's a serendipity to it. I can listen to the Leonard Lopez show from my home in Toronto on WNYC.org. That was a plug, by the way.
Yeah, but thank you, but it's true.
And yet I don't. I listen to my local CBC radio station because I turn it on and
sorry to hear that.
I hear the serendipity of it, right? There's something special to that, again, when it stops being the norm.
How do these younger people develop a taste for this if it wasn't part of their experience, their original experience?
I think they do so by, one, sort of engaging in a slightly latent nostalgia, right? What did my parents have? These record collections, these book collections, these physical things, they're still there. They're sitting around people's houses and they're being sold at places like Urban Outfitters. I think another thing is that, you know, if you're a young person, you want to establish your identity through art, through culture, through some sort of commerce. the phone doesn't allow you much variation, right? Everybody buys all their books on Amazon. There's two or three streaming services. Everybody either has an Apple or a Samsung, and the Samsungs are all exploding, so it's pretty much all Apples now. And yet, in the world of analog, if you're a young person living in Williamsburg or the East Village and you want to establish your identity as someone in this world, analog provides an opportunity to do so in a way that's very individualistic and unique. Your record collection, Leonard, is completely different from my record collection because it comes, even if we own the same records, because they come from a different place. Each one has a different story behind it. And in the world of digital, everyone's stuff is the same.
I'm predicting that people are going to start buying old 30-inch TV sets, black and white.
Right.
Maybe not. David Sachs is my guest. His latest book is The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. It is published in hardcover by Public Affairs. I imagine there also is a digital version of this book. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of the other things that have gone digital or that people still are returning to in their analog form. Stay with us for more. And we are back with David Sachs, who's a writer and reporter who specializes in business and culture. And his latest book is The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. It's published by Public Affairs. When you say that there's a resurgence, you aren't talking about industries going back to the same levels they were before the digital revolution. And we're not going to see Kodak start making roll film again, are we?
Kodak still makes roll film. So they haven't got, that hasn't actually gone away. What I'm talking about is growth in these areas, right? It was assumed that film, paper, books, bookstores, records, all these things would simply wither away and die. Brick and mortar bookstores, we would buy everything online.
Most of them have closed. The big chains have closed, the big record store chains, the big bookstore chains.
Right. And yet then what's happened in the subsequent decades, really the past 10 or so years in all these industries, is that it's begun growing again. Bookstores are a great example, right? I think if I said 10 years ago that, you know, there's going to be a boom in independent bookstores opening up in New York City and around the country, you would say, you know, you're absolutely insane. Look at Amazon, look what they can do in terms of price and selection. And yet that's exactly what's happened.
But it's more likely to be an independent bookstore, a small one, a small record store
right.
that's selling vinyl. And that's perhaps because there's also a sense of community in those stores. Whereas if you go to one of the older bookstores, well, that don't exist anymore, like Walden Books, et cetera, they just felt like they were generic. Well, Barnes & Noble seems to be the last holdout, and they, as far as I understand, are struggling.
Right, and I think a big part of that is, again, the changing value of the product and the retailer in the place. So today, if you go to buy a book in a bookstore, you are making a conscious choice to pay more money than you would online and to go somewhere that is not going to have the same selection as Amazon.
So is this a good thing for the mom-and-pop independent stores? They don't have to compete with the brick-and-mortar chains?
I think it is. I think it allows people to create an individual identity and to really set themselves out in the market in a way that, again, speaks to who their core customer is, right? It's almost as though, listen, all bets are off. You know Amazon's going to own that bottom of the market in terms of the lowest price and the biggest selection. But, you know, if you can do something else, you know, feel free to do it.
How much of this is also a matter of economics? For example, if you're making Polaroid film now, it's got to be a lot more expensive than it was when Polaroid was making Polaroid film.
It is. And I think that's why you see these things being, you know, quite expensive. So Impossible Project, the company that bought the last existing Polaroid factory in the world in the Netherlands and sort of turned it around to make a new product, you pay, I think, $25 for a pack of 8 pictures, whereas with originally Polaroid is probably, I think probably at its last point, like $10 or $12 for a pack of 10. It doesn't work nearly as well as it did then, but it's a limited product and it's a luxury today. So people are willing to pay for that because they're getting something tangible again.
And what about Polaroid cameras?
Well, Impossible Project actually they began making their own camera this year. So they were buying up all the old Polaroid cameras they could get their hands on, refurbishing and repackaging. And earlier this year, they came out with their own version, which is kind of a marriage of digital and analog. It takes a picture like a Polaroid camera, but you can control certain aspects of shutter speed and exposure with your smartphone.
Do I see that you're still wearing an analog watch?
This is the watch I got for my bar mitzvah. It's still ticking.
So what about analog watches? Do they still remain more popular than Apple watches?
I believe so. I mean, I don't know the figures on this. You know, analog watches were really disrupted back in the 70s when the Japanese came out with the sort of digital quartz watch. And there's a professor at Harvard, Ryan Raffaelli, who's done a study of this. The Swiss watch industry was decimated because they were all about accuracy of timekeeping. And when the Japanese could do it better for, you know, $5, the Swiss had this big crisis. And then what happened is they changed their identity. The watch became a fashion item, whether it was a $40 Swatch or a $40,000 Patek Philippe. It wasn't so much about keeping time. It was about something to wear on your wrist that spoke about who you are, right? This thing may not be as accurate as my iPhone, but I don't have to take it out of my pocket every time I'm wearing it. And it tells a story about me. It means something to me to wear.
What did Bruce Chatwin have to do with the resurgence of Moleskine notebooks? Now, Bruce Chatwin died, I think, 1989 or so. That was at a period before the digital era was really taking hold.
Mm-hmm. Maria Sabrigondi, who's the Italian woman that essentially created the company Moleskine that we know today, in 1997, she was sort of looking for a product to make for this line of items which were sort of about the contemporary nomad, right? This is the dawn of globalization and sort of world travelers who were just starting to work anywhere around email. And she was reading Songlines, a book by Chatwin, and she came across this essay about these beloved notebooks that he got in Paris every time he went there. These were his favorite travel journals, and he couldn't find them anymore. And she realized these were the same notebooks that she used when she was studying in Paris years before at design school. And wouldn't it be great to sort of recreate them, because the company that made them was no longer in business? They were called Moleskines as almost a generic name. It wasn't a brand name. And what she did, and eventually turned into the company Moleskine, is recreated this product based on that original design, but branded it with sort of the romance of Chatwin and Hemingway and Picasso, who used similar notebooks that didn't have the Moleskine stamp on them.
Did it become a kind of identification mark, like a Toyota Prius projecting someone's values?
I think Karl Rove once called them the sort of symbol of insufferable liberals. So I suppose, you know, we can hold our Moleskines high while we march to the barricades in the next 4 years.
Karl Rove got upset about people having Moleskines?
Yes, yeah. And yet he probably uses one, right? I think if you go into any coffee shop in this city, or even the you know, most advanced tech startup around here, you're going to see people sitting with iPads and iPhones and MacBooks and other computers, but they're always going to have a Moleskine or a Field Notes journal or some paper notebook beside them. It's become the analog accessory of sort of the digital economy.
Even though you can type all of those notes into your phone.
You can, but what can't you do? You can't draw in the same way. You can't scribble something out. When you're on your phone, other messages are popping up. When I want to get an idea down from my head to a physical place without any interference, a piece of paper is still the best and most simple way.
What kinds of digital businesses, are digital businesses responding to this? Are they making adjustments?
I think so. I mean, there are many digital businesses that see an opportunity in this market, right? Kickstarter is a great example. So many of these projects, whether it's film cameras, board games, even, you know, new vinyl record projects begin as sort of crowdfunding Kickstarter projects online to meet their niche market, get their money and go. But even at big companies like Facebook and Google and Yelp, what you're seeing is even in the heart of those Silicon Valley companies, they see where analog has a benefit. There's a gentleman named John Skigel. He teaches a class that's now adapted across Google, which is how to sketch on paper. And it's so people who are designing things at Google, for that first step of brainstorming, don't go into the computer and immediately start working with the format they know. They're free to express their idea in a way that gets it down very quickly, but they're not tied to it. And so you see this at a bunch of different digital companies.
We had a segment recently on a discussion about whether penmanship was necessary anymore. Now, penmanship is very analog. Old timers are horrified at the thought that kids are not being taught how to write in longhand.
And I think you see, first of all, studies that show the benefit of this, cognitive benefits for learning and memory retention, as well as, you know, benefits to stress and you know, even to making people think in a certain way, right? I have horrible penmanship, by the way, so I'm not the person to speak.
Well, can
about
you read
this.
What you've written? That's the
half the time. Yeah, I haven't been sued for libel yet because
well,
of the notes.
Well, where does digital fit into the future of education?
Well, that's a really interesting thing. I mean, I think you've seen, you know, the promise of digital's potential to transform education touted since the beginning of the PC age. And it's always going to, you know, come in, change the way we learn, change schools. We're not going to need teachers. We're not going to need schools. And time again, it comes up short. I mean, I think we've seen this most recently with the tablet, the great promise that the tablet could change. And now I think it's, you know, virtual reality. And the reality is that, you know, again, digital often offers this great transformative utopian promise, but the rubber still needs to meet the road. And the reality is that teaching and learning is an intrinsically human interaction. We still need teachers to get that information across, even if people are using computers to get it.
What happened to the one laptop per child nonprofit from Nicholas Negroponte?
Right. This is the perfect example. This was, you know, we were going to airdrop laptops into various parts of the poorer world. And once these children had laptops, they would download the information they need and be able to work and learn in ways that they couldn't before. And even though a lot of experts in education and global education said, listen, this is not what people need. They need clean schools. They need access to safe schools. They need peace in their country. You know, millions and millions were raised for this program. It was implemented. And then the studies came out and said it actually made no difference or a negative difference to those students. You see this with laptop giveaway programs and tech giveaway programs across the world, whether it's the wealthy world or the developing world.
Still, we're seeing the demise of magazines. We're seeing newspapers in serious trouble, many newspapers going out of business as well. This is all because digital has taken over. In fact, any number of publications are only available digitally now.
The economics of it are real. And for a legacy media organization, someone like the New York Times or Condé Nast publication that relies on a model that was sort of built in the 1950s, that adjustment is very difficult. I think what you're going to see is the opposite. New publications that are starting up, things like Monocle Magazine, which started in 2007, which, again, are coming into the market knowing the reality of that and building for a smaller audience, a niche audience, with the financial model that can support it. Because we need that journalism. We need that product more than ever.
David Sacks will be speaking with A.J. Jacobs at Book Culture tonight at 7 o'clock. That's at 450 Columbus Avenue. His book, The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter, it's published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.